This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The reporter Daniel Pearl would have celebrated his 43rd birthday today. Pearl was kidnapped and beheaded by Islamic extremists in 2002 while reporting in Pakistan for the Wall Street Journal. A documentary about his life and death will be shown tonight on HBO. After his death, his father, Judea Pearl, wanted to start a series of dialogues with a Muslim partner to exchange ideas and air grievances in the hopes of reaching common ground. Several people recommended Akbar Ahmed, a professor of Islamic studies at American University in Washington, D.C. Since 2003, they've spoken together at forums around the country and recently received the $100,000 Purpose Prize for fighting intolerance, conflict, and terrorism through dialogue. Pearl and Ahmed are my guests. Judea Pearl grew up in Israel. He's a professor of computer sciences at UCLA and founded the Daniel Pearl Foundation to promote cross-cultural understanding through journalism and music. Akbar Ahmed grew up in Pakistan and formerly served as Pakistan's ambassador to the UK. Akbar Ahmed, Judea Pearl, welcome to Fresh Air. Judea Pearl, you've said that one of the things you wanted these interfaith dialogues with Akbar Ahmed to accomplish was to air the grievances that you each had. What were the grievances you wanted to bring up in this dialogue?
The main grievance that the Jewish community holds against the Muslim community is that we do not hear the voice of the moderate Muslims loud and clear against terrorism, specifically against the suicide bombers in Israel, and as well against suicide bombers in Iraq. The other grievance we have is the anti-Zionist rhetorics that borders on insults in many of the writings and speeches of Muslim leaders. These are the two main grievances, and I am sure that Akbar has similar grievances toward our communities.
Akbar Ahmed, can I ask you, Judea Pearl says that one of his grievances is where are the voices of the moderate Muslims who oppose suicide bombers? What do you say? I'm sure people ask you that a lot. So what do you say?
Well, Terry, you're talking to one of them. No, my answer seriously is that you need to tune up your hearing aid a little bit higher, because there are many, many Muslims talking. I don't call them moderates and fundamentalists, and these words are meaningless, but there are thousands and thousands of Muslims risking their lives, standing up and talking, defying tyrannical regimes, sometimes being killed, sometimes being marginalized, sometimes being chased out. All of us who've lived in the Muslim world have suffered for this. I've personally suffered. I've been attacked both in writing and print and sometimes physically, and it is a very difficult exercise. What we need to do is to be heard. We are just not heard. So what happens is that the Western media very often picks up the extremist voices who may be limited in their impact, who may have a very small following, and yet their importance is exaggerated to the point where people begin to feel that they represent mainstream society. And the fact of the matter is they simply don't. And this is confirmed by election after election after election in normal times. The religious or the fanatical or the extremist groups have never done well in normal times in any election in the Muslim world.
And Judea Pearl, does that satisfy your...
No, it doesn't. Uh-huh. Even the moderate leaders of the Muslims, of Muslim society, they speak against the violence associated with terrorism, but they do not speak against the incitement. Most Muslim leaders, play the game of condemning violence and fueling the anger. You ought to be angry, you have reason to be angry, but do not resort to violence. This is a mixed message that is very dangerous, and we do not want this to happen.
Do you each feel like you've changed your mind about something or learned about something that you didn't already know or comprehend from listening to the other speak?
Sure. I learned a lot about the mindset of Muslim society. I learned, for instance, that they are extremely devout, religious, that religious metaphors means a lot, whereas we in the West tend to belittle the significance of the religious terminology or religious metaphors. They are taken very seriously in the Muslim society, and we should be very sensitive to it. And that works both ways, both sensitive to and able to utilize that language in order to advance, in order to communicate. And this is the reason why I have been advocating for many months now the use of fatwa as a means for moderate Muslims to fight terrorisms. It is a language understood by a person in the street. The secular language is totally dismissed.
And Akbar Ahmed, what do you think of Judea Pearl's idea of Muslim leaders issuing fatwas against terrorism?
Well, that's one of the points that I raised when we first talked, that we had many examples of Muslims, particularly Muslims prominent in the media here in the West, who were so secular that they were completely cut off from their own communities, and therefore no one took them too seriously, or they were not able to alter very much in their own communities. So Judea is absolutely right. You must fight fire with fire. So if you need to take on the extremists, the fanatics, you need to do it in the context within which that culture works. This is the whole point. This is the whole point of what's happening in Iraq, what's happening in Afghanistan. This is the point of understanding that we don't completely comprehend here in the West, and that's why we fail. We are failing in both these countries. If we had been able to fight this battle in a different way, I think the outcome would have been very different. So I completely agree that you've got to couch your terms, your debate, the references within the context of a particular culture.
What I'd like to do is spend a little bit of time with each of you talking individually. So, Judea Pearl, if I may talk with you first, one-on-one.
Sure.
We're broadcasting this interview on October 10th, and this is the day that would have been your son's birthday. What are some of the things that you and the foundation you created in his name are doing to honor him today?
The main project on that day is the Daniel Pearl World Music Day, where we put together hundreds of concerts by thousands of musicians in honor of his life and in honor of the ideals for which he stood, and giving a chance for musicians to express their commitment to tolerance and humanity.
When your son was executed by Islamist extremists, why did you want dialogue and concert events as opposed to just anger?
Well, I'm an engineer and I'm result driven, and I would like, and I'm committed to fight the hatred that took my son's life, and I have to do it in the most effective ways available to me, giving the resources in my position. And I have only one tiny resource, and this is a legacy of a person who earned respect on both sides of the East-West divide. And there aren't many such icons. We have one, and we have to use it effectively. So what means are available to me? What ways can I exploit that weapon to get to the end result, which is reduction of hatred?
When your son, Danny Pearl, became the South Asia bureau chief for the Wall Street Journal and started covering extremism in Pakistan, were you worried about him? And were you worried specifically about him being Jewish, covering Islamist extremists?
I should say that, first, Danny never concealed his Jewish origin. And he spent many years in the Middle East. He had a way of charming his audiences and making his open-mindedness and his universal posture known and shine. So, and he also, at that time, he believed that he has an aura of protection by being a journalist. You should remember that he was the first journalist that was abducted and killed under such circumstances. At that time, we didn't understand that terrorism will get so entrenched in the mores of our culture. That was after the U.S. decided to bomb Afghanistan. There were demonstrations in Pakistan, but I don't think people understood that that is going to become part of a normative life as it developed later in Iraq and elsewhere. So in a sense, he was a victim for being the first.
Judea-Pearl, what were your son's last words before he was beheaded? This was recorded on tape so that we know what the last words were.
He said, "My name is Daniel Pearl. I'm an American Jewish journalist from Encino, California. My father is Jewish, my mother is Jewish, and I'm Jewish." And then he added one more sentence, which is still puzzling to my ears. It is, "Back in the town of Bnei Brak, there is a street named after my great-grandfather, Chaim Pearl, who was one of the founders of the town." And we are still trying to decipher the reason that in such critical moment of a person's life, his mind would stumble on an anecdotal story in our family lore. We haven't elaborated on that story. We've probably been in that street only once. And for some reason, his mind stumbled on that story. I can write volumes of interpretation of what he meant by that, but that will be partly speculation and partly wishful thinking. So, and by the way, this sentence they could not possibly have forced him to say, because only our family knew about that street in Bnei Brak. So it might have been a code for him to tell us, "I'm doing okay and I'm speaking freely." But obviously they have selected and pasted together sentences that they consider to be incriminating, namely those connected with Judaism.
What impact did it have on you to know that it was beheading that ended your son's life, that that's what he...
Well, obviously it's a symbolic act that represents defeat. We have defeated you, and this is the ultimate symbol of defeat, cutting someone's head. To us, it means different. It means you have tried to make your point and you made a mistake, which means the mistake that Danny's murderers made is bringing that camera into that dungeon in Pakistan, because by zooming in on Danny's face, they zoomed world attention onto American education, the character of American people, their open-mindedness, their friendliness, namely the character that Danny represented. And that is not exactly the image of Americans and Jews that the murderers tried to advertise. And that was their defeat, not ours.
I'm assuming that you have never watched any of the video of your son's execution.
I watched the benevolent part, the first part where he recite his narrative.
And then you turned it off before getting to the execution.
Sure.
Does it upset you knowing that there are videos someplace of that?
It does. But perhaps for a different reason than people think. I don't think we should be defeated. And being exposed to such scenes, no matter how much we resist it, it induces a feeling of defeat. And we ain't going to be defeated. We are going to win this war.
And when you say win this war, what do you mean by winning?
I mean eradicating the hatred that took Danny's life. There is a clear war here between those who boast in the killing of innocent journalists and those who are abhorred by such actions. It's very clear. If there's anything that Danny's tragedy has given us, it is the idea that right and wrong are right and wrong. Namely, that moral relativism is dead. It died with Danny in Karachi in 2002. There is right and wrong. And there's no ifs and no buts. There is right and wrong. Those who killed Danny are simply wrong in absolute terms.
Judea Pearl, thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you for having me.
Judea Pearl created the Daniel Pearl Foundation in honor of his late son. A documentary about Daniel Pearl's life and death will be shown tonight on HBO. My guest is Akbar Ahmed, a professor of Islamic studies at American University in Washington, D.C. Since 2003, he's been holding a series of interfaith dialogues with Judea Pearl, the father of the journalist Daniel Pearl, who was beheaded by Islamic extremists. Ahmed has been involved in interfaith dialogues for many years. His book, Discovering Islam, was the basis of a BBC series. His latest book is called Islam Under Siege. He was born in India, but his parents moved the family to the newly created Muslim state of Pakistan in 1947. I asked him why his parents wanted to live in a Muslim state.
I think all of us want to live in freedom, however attractive it is living in a country which is perpetually ruled or administered by people who are of a different faith or culture. We do want our own freedoms. The Americans wanted their own freedom. They could have been very happy under the British colonial system, under the King of England, but they wanted their own country. Every country, every people want their own country, and the Muslims of India wanted to live as independent people. So they fought for their independence from the British and got the state of Pakistan.
Something that seems kind of paradoxical in your life is that after your parents give up everything to move to the newly created state of Pakistan, the new Muslim state, they send you to Catholic school.
Not really paradoxical. If you know the traditions of South Asia, you'll understand that some of the finest schools there are run by Christian missionaries. They're very popular and they're accepted. And we grew up in this Muslim country, in a school run by Catholic missionaries. And my wife and my sisters were at a parallel school run by nuns, Catholic nuns. And these still remain the most popular schools in Pakistan. And a lot of the well-known names come from these schools. Benazir Bhutto, for example, was at the convent run by the Catholic nuns. And we really learned as young boys at this boarding school up in North Pakistan the values that these priests embodied. And I know they get a terrible press here in the United States, but these were extraordinary human beings. They represented piety, they were virtuous, they were hardworking, and they were always father figures to us. So we really learned a great deal from them about their faith and about life in general. And these qualities have stood by and benefited us throughout our lives.
Now, in one of your books, you write about like how, you know, like a lot of people in your generation in South Asia, you grew up with the vision of being educated at Oxford or Cambridge. Why was that important to you and so many other people of your generation? And why do you think that has changed in the sense that now in Pakistan, there is so much hatred of the United States and of England as opposed to, and you might want to correct me on that, maybe that's not the way you see it, but I know in some circles there certainly is. So instead of a desire to go there and be educated, there's a desire on the part of many to attack.
A very good question. When I was growing up in the 1960s, after my schooling at Burnhall, I was at Foreman Christian College in Lahore, a premier college of Pakistan, where President Musharraf studied, and very respected, very popular, and run by American missionaries, Protestants from the United States. We loved our teachers, and they were wonderful, wonderful people, wonderful mentors, always welcoming, asking us to come to the United States for education. But in the 60s, until the 60s, the trend was among young Pakistanis to come to the United Kingdom to try to get to Oxford or Cambridge. We were just coming out of the colonial era, and England really was very much on the horizon as the great country to visit and to be educated at. And you're right, over the next generation, I saw how the backlash began to build up against Western culture, against Western education, against Western schooling, so that a priest, a Christian priest, killed himself. A bishop shot himself a few years ago in Pakistan. There was such despair in him. And you can imagine a Christian priest killing himself when he's not allowed to commit suicide, wanting to express the extent of despair in his community. And I just thought to myself, my God, in one generation from these figures of authority and beloved figures that were the priests of my generation to a time when Christian bishops are killing themselves, what has happened to us as a society, as Muslims? Have we become so intolerant? Have we become so fanatical? Have we closed our minds? And there is a crisis taking place in Muslim societies generally. It is a crisis of education, of politics, of morality, of direction, and it's not being helped by the lack of understanding in the West about what's happening in the Muslim world.
Akbar Ahmed is a professor of Islamic studies at American University. His latest book is called Islam Under Siege. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Akbar Ahmed. Since 2003, he's been holding a series of public interfaith dialogues with Judea Pearl, the father of the journalist Daniel Pearl, who was beheaded in Pakistan in 2002. Ahmed was born in India and moved with his parents to the newly created Muslim state of Pakistan in 1947. He studied at Cambridge University and London University and served as Pakistan's ambassador to the UK. He's now a professor of Islamic studies at American University. His latest book is called Islam Under Siege. What were the first signs that you saw of radical Islam?
I think the first signs I saw of this new phenomena called radical Islam were in the 1990s in the United Kingdom. When I talked of dialogue, I was one of the first, probably the first Muslim to be invited to talk at this major synagogue in London. And then at a chapel in Cambridge to address the Evensong. These were really firsts taking place in the United Kingdom in terms of interfaith dialogue. And I was attacked by a lot of radical Muslims who said that Akbar has sold out and he's gone to a synagogue and a church and he should be punished and he should be excommunicated and all kinds of violent things. Now, this debate was taking place in the Muslim press. I also had a lot of supporters, including imams, who said that what Akbar is doing is the correct thing, that Islam preaches and teaches interfaith dialogue and understanding and compassion and bridge building. So in a sense, when I hear this question, where are the moderates, I simply reply, you must look a bit harder and you must listen a bit more carefully. There are moderates and there have been moderates fighting this battle long before 9/11. It is your problem that you are not able to see them. You've suddenly discovered this question after 9/11. You should have discovered this question before 9/11, and maybe 9/11 would not have happened. Maybe the moderates would have succeeded and the fanatics and the extremists would not have been able to perpetrate this terrible crime on 9/11 and kill thousands of innocent people. But the debate was taking place, and I saw this happening in the United Kingdom, and I said, my God, there is a storm coming here, because unless mainstream society understands what is happening, they will all be involved in it. And I'm sorry to say, no one either understood or bothered. They all thought that this was a sort of typical community problem dealing with some esoteric part of some alien exotic community from Asia.
One of the people who denounced you for participating in interfaith dialogues and for speaking at a chapel and at a synagogue was Sheikh Omar Bakri, who later declared himself to be bin Laden's chief agent in the UK. What was it like to confront him, and what was he doing at the time that he first denounced you? Maybe you could tell us approximately what year this was.
Sheikh Bakri in the mid-90s was a very powerful and a noisy figure in the United Kingdom, mainly because of the media. He didn't have so much support in the community, but he was always in the media saying the most outrageous things. And he saw me as a kind of conceptual opposite to where he stood. He denounced me as a person who's talking to the Jews and the Christians. And he said, Akbar is too influenced by Western civilization. He called me an Uncle Tom, all kinds of things. Now, when a leader begins to whip up emotion, the danger is that some young, uneducated, illiterate idiot is so motivated that he may go and do something violent. And my family was always concerned. My wife was always worried about this. my neighbor in Cambridge, Sir David Lane, a wonderful, wonderful statesman from England, a member of parliament, a former minister in the cabinet, was very concerned. He said, Akbar, you should go and report this to the police because you just don't know. There's so much hatred this man is spewing against you. And I said, no, he knows where I live and everyone knows where I live and I'm not going to back down. This is a battle that has to be fought. And we must be out there fighting this battle. And one of the hazards is the fact that something violent may happen. Nothing happened. And of course, I continued my campaign to have dialogue and be committed to dialogue. And I was able to go to synagogues, churches, even Hindu temples. And I always found a very warm and very positive response from people of these faiths as I visited them.
One of the things I don't understand, and I think a lot of people share this confusion, is why does somebody like Sheikh Omar Bakri leave his country of Syria, go to the United Kingdom, where he's going to have more freedom to speak, and then turn against the country that has given you that freedom?
I didn't understand this idea either, and I would constantly tell my Muslim audiences that they were very privileged, very lucky to be in the United Kingdom. It's a very tolerant society. And yet you had these emerging figures talking and practicing hatred. What was dangerous is the Western media, by constantly picking them up and injecting them into the discourse, they took marginal figures and made them mainstream. So it did two things. It gave the impression in the Western mind that all Islam meant was these terrorist, fanatical, extremist, wild-eyed characters like Bakri. And what it did to the Muslims was convince them that people like Bakri were the genuine leaders. After all, they may have seen them on the BBC last night or heard them on the radio that morning, and they were convinced these are our leaders. They speak for us.
Yeah, you have a great line in one of your books. You say, and I'm paraphrasing here, that religion is no longer the opiate of the masses. It's more like speed. So I'm going to ask you to elaborate on that.
Well, a century ago, Nietzsche had said that religion is dead, and Karl Marx, even before that in the 19th century, talked of religion as an opiate of the masses, having dismissed it. So the common belief in the 19th century was that religion is outdated, that the future is going to be progressive, socialist, scientific, and so on. There will be no room for religion. And yet we see today in the 21st century, there is nothing but religion in one form or another form. So whether it's the United States, whether it's the Muslim world, whether it's Hinduism, whether it's Buddhism, there is great interest in religion because human beings essentially want answers. They want to be able to communicate. They want to be able to relate. They want to be able to understand what they're doing here on this, in this physical sense, on this planet. And religion, in one way or the other, helps them find these answers. It may not be strictly formal religion. It may be distorted versions of religion, and we are seeing a lot of that in this century. But it is religion in a very broad sense, and religion really is on speed right now because we are seeing religion in some of its most crude and brazen forms. So we are not seeing so much of the compassion and the balance and the beauty of religion. We are seeing more of this aggressive hostility of religion.
Do you think it's been difficult to convince the followers of radical Islam that their form of Islam is not the true way?
It is difficult. I have constantly tried to communicate this message of compassionate Islam to a variety of Muslim audiences, and I talk to Muslim audiences throughout the world. When I talk to them, they come up with standard answers. You'll hear them everywhere. They'll give a long list of complaints of these predicament of the Palestinians, of the Kashmiris, of the Chechen in the Balkans. They'll talk about Muslim countries like Afghanistan and Iraq being invaded. They'll talk about the natural resources being exploited. And they'll talk about their own leaders being simple puppets of the West set up to exploit the nations. And they'll talk about a great sense of anger and frustration and despair and all these emotions mixed up in a very volatile mixture, and I think a very dangerous mixture. So it is very difficult for a Muslim to be constantly hammering and taking one position. I have nonetheless pointed out that it is totally unacceptable to be using the rhetoric of anti-Semitism, to be practicing and preaching violence, as in the example of Danny Pearl and this brutal killing of this young man. It makes an impact. A lot of Muslims do listen. A lot of them have translated my books and have read them, and it obviously makes some kind of an impact on some of them. But it is a debate, and this will be the big debate of the 21st century. It will only be helped if people like you, Terry, are able to enter the debate, understand it, and push it in a certain direction. Because if you leave it and assume, like many people in the West unfortunately do assume, that the Muslim world is a monolith, we then do have a problem. Because if it is a monolith, we have a problem, because then you're talking about 1.4 billion people, 57 states, one nuclear for the time being, and a mood of anger and anti-Americanism, which I have not seen in my years.
You're a professor of Islamic studies at American University in Washington, and you've written that you think that a generation of scholars has basically been eliminated in some countries, some Muslim countries like Algeria and like Afghanistan. What's been responsible for that, and what impact do you think that that's had on Muslim scholarship and the way Islam is Islam is practiced?
Thank you for asking this very important question, Terry. This question is not asked in the Western media, unfortunately. We must understand what's going on in Muslim society when scholars who speak up, who talk about the truth, who tell the truth as it is, and they're not liked by their rulers, who are very often dictators. Look at the Muslim world, 57 states, mostly run by dictators of one kind or another. So no dictator likes people to stand up and say, we don't approve of what you're doing, or what you're doing is wrong. And very often scholars are beaten up or killed or chased out of the country. And very often they end up here in the USA or the United Kingdom. So there has been a devastating exodus of scholars from the Muslim world. And I believe that the Muslim world is really, in a sense, paying for that and will continue to pay for that. So when you look at this, that the quality of education available in the Muslim world, in my youth in the 1960s when we were undergraduates, we really looked to a very bright future in the Muslim world. We were hoping for societies that would be taking off, which would become part of the world community of nations, which would be able to compete and contribute. And what we see today is these societies in the Muslim world falling back. When you look at the educational figures, the health figures, the figures for all kinds of other statistics in the UNDP report published by the United Nations, you'll see that we do have major problems. And one of the basic problems is the treatment of the scholars in the Muslim world.
My guest is Akbar Ahmed, a professor of Islamic studies at American University. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Akbar Ahmed, a professor of Islamic studies at American University. He's participated in interfaith dialogues for many years, including a continuing series of public dialogues with Judea Pearl, the father of the journalist Daniel Pearl, who was beheaded in Pakistan in 2003. One of the reasons that you've offered to explain why it's been difficult to counter radical Islam is that you say the role of the clerics, the mullahs and the sheikhs isn't as, it's not as big a role as, say, in Judaism, the rabbis in Judaism, or the priests in Christianity. And yet it seems like, you know, sheikhs and mullahs have so much power now. Look at Iran, in which the clerics seem to run a good deal of the country. So, can you explain that? Why you say that clerics in Islam don't have as much power as their counterparts?
There's some simple rules to understand this very important question. Iran is a Shia country. In Shia social structure, clerics do have a great deal of authority and power historically, for all kinds of reasons, which I won't go into. As distinct from the Shia are the Sunni. The Sunni are the majority of the Muslim world, which is about 90%. Now, among the Sunnis, the clerics do not have that status or authority as they do have among the Shia, except in times of emergency or except in times of the emergence of a charismatic religious figure. So you may have a figure who emerges and people rally around him and say, what a wonderful representative he is. In normal times, you'll see all the great movements in the last century in the Muslim world were led again and again by mainstream figures, not by religious figures. Jinnah of Pakistan, the founding father, Ataturk in Turkey, in Morocco, the king, King Mohammed V, all these are normal, ordinary, everyday figures, not religious figures. This is a very important distinction. What you're seeing now after 9/11 is that the Western media somehow focuses on religious figures and inflates them to the point of only seeing them and constantly saying, Where are the moderates? Where are the other figures? They're just not seeing them. The other figures are there. They're very much in play, and they're very much battling their corner.
But even you ask in one of your books, what happened to Islam's... Actually, this was in an op-ed piece. You wrote, what happened to Islam's gentle voices? So even you are asking that question.
No, I'm asking a different question. I'm asking about the gentle voices, because even the moderates, and this is what is frightening, Terry, even the moderates now are exasperated, and they are no longer speaking in a gentle voice. And that reason is because of the direct relationship, which is again missed in Western analysis, between what is happening here in the United States and its impact over there in the Muslim world. So every time someone attacks the Prophet of Islam, or the God of Islam, or the religion of Islam, or desecrates the Quran, or is supposed to have desecrated the Quran, it has an immediate impact in the Muslim world, because Muslims are traditionally a religious people. They have great reverence for their own religion and their customs and their traditions. And therefore, what that does is it reinforces, it elevates religious authority in that society. So, and that also encourages an irrational anger, a response which is not reasoned or compassionate. And that marginalizes those people who are speaking of love or compassion, which is the mainstream tradition. If you look at the great poetry and the literature in Muslim societies, whether it's Rumi or Hafiz, or in my part of the world, Ghalib and Iqbal, they're all talking about love of compassion. If you look at the rhetoric today, it is all about violence and hatred and blowing up people and blowing themselves up. And I am seeing a dramatic shift taking place in society. And one of the reasons is exactly this, that there is the world of the international media. You have CNN, BBC, Fox being seen all over the world. You see what's happening here, and these images and these words, and sometimes very spiteful and hateful, are being flashed across the Muslim world, and that is feeding into the anger and the emotion. And therefore, the voices of compassion, dialogue, discussion are simply being drowned out.
I understand what you're saying. Not that I'd know, but I'm not sure it's completely fair to blame the media for the anger and for the power that radical voices in the Islam world have now.
You can't find blame in one single monocausal factor. As a social scientist, you look for different strands in a society. One of the strands is the media. One of the strands is the impact of what is being seen in the global media. There is no doubt about it. I have just come back from the Muslim world. I had a group of wonderful young American students with me, and we conducted questionnaires, interviews, and again what came up was what they were seeing in the Western media. And what they were seeing in the Western media was literally they were seeing Islam under attack. So they'd constantly say, why are you attacking us? Why do you hate us? Why are you enemies of Islam? And I would have to answer that question to audiences of 500, 600 people in mosques, in madrasas. And then I'd ask my American students, I'd say, look, if we were your enemies, would I have these wonderful American kids with me? And I'd ask them, I'd say, look, please stand up and speak to them. And I'd say, these American students have come all the way to the Muslim world. They're sitting with you in a mosque, taking this huge risk, knowing what terrible things you're capable of doing, and trusting your hospitality and fairness. And they'd respond. They'd respond very carefully, very, very positively. They'd say, you're the first Americans we've talked to. And these students would then talk about the need to understand, about the respect, and so on.
Now, isn't the Arab media partly responsible for anger being whipped up? You know, the new Arab cable stations, from the little I know about them, seem to be very fiery in their anti-Western rhetoric.
Yes, certainly. The local media is always fiery. They always reflect a certain position of the government. Their aim is obviously to stir up things so more people will see their channel or hear their channel. It's the same thing as media anywhere in the world. These are universal rules of the media anywhere. It's what ratings are all about, what sales are all about. And that is my point, that there is a great deal of irresponsibility I find in the media. Why I have high expectations of the Western media is because I hoped that Western media would understand its huge importance in the world today and assume that responsibility and not play this particular game. It is a game that can be played by anyone, and it is being played, as you point out, by other people. So what it is doing, you take the ordinary individual Muslim young man in Cairo or Karachi or Kabul, and all he's seeing is local media and international media, and his emotions are constantly being whipped up. They're like a tornado. They're like a cyclone. And then if someone comes along and says, now blow yourself up, he may be tempted to do so. If I came along, as I've been doing, and came and said, talk about compassion and dialogue, he'd say, who the hell are you? What are you talking about? I'm being abused. I'm being attacked. My religion is being attacked. My prophet is being attacked. I am mad with anger. And therefore, we have to understand these connections and try to connect the dots.
Well, what kind of compromise would you like to see?
I would like to see more respect for people's traditions and cultures. I would like to see a more sensitivity, greater sensitivity. In the United States, we talk about freedom of expression. We are very sensitive about certain words regarding the African American people, rightly. We are very sensitive about the Jewish people, very rightly. We need to be sensitive about other cultures, other peoples. We don't say certain things that other people may be saying outside the United States. Why can't we be sensitive about the Muslims? Why are Muslims suddenly a community that you can kick around and boot around and humiliate and suddenly talk about this strange community which is not capable of understanding the age we're living in, when we are also sensitive about everyone else?
But everybody else is the subject of satire. Everybody else is the subject of cartoons and plays.
I'm sorry, Terry. I disagree, Terry. You cannot say the N-word, for example. Let's be very clear about this. You can't say this on your show, because you're not sensitive enough. You're very sensitive about it. You don't want to risk offending people. And rightly, you cannot go around offending people. You cannot simply show contempt for an entire race or people. And you're sensitive to it, and therefore you don't do it. Then why are you not sensitive about other people like the Muslims? Aren't they citizens of the United States? Don't you have 7 million Muslims living here? Don't you have millions of Muslims who are allies of the United States? You have countries in the world today who are close allies of the United States. Or don't you care? Don't you care for them at all? Or you simply care for your own people here in the United States?
My guest is Akbar Ahmad, a professor of Islamic studies at American University. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Akbar Ahmad, a professor of Islamic studies at American University. He's participated in interfaith dialogues for many years, including a continuing series of public dialogues with Judea Pearl, the father of the late journalist Daniel Pearl, who was beheaded in Pakistan in 2003. Would you explain why visual depictions, artistic depictions of the Prophet Muhammad are seen as blasphemy, and why Muslims are so or at least some Muslims are so sensitive, so offended by it?
That's a very good question, and I wish it's asked more often in the Western media here. The Prophet is the embodiment of the Quran, which Muslims believe, rightly or wrongly, that the Quran is the word of God. The Prophet translates that word. And therefore, he holds a very high status in Islam itself. To attack the Prophet is to attack the base, the foundations of faith itself. That's how important the Prophet is in Islam. In our question is, on these travels that we conducted recently with these American students of mine, every Muslim we talk to, rich or poor, man or woman, secular or traditional, for all of them, the greatest role model was invariably the Prophet of Islam. Now, if that is the case, Terry, you ask yourself, if 1.4 billion people are saying to us, this is the greatest role model, and you come along and start calling him a pedophile and a terrorist and a fanatic and an extremist and make remarks about him along these lines, and then you expect to win hearts and minds and say it's important that we win your hearts and minds, here a couple of dollars, do you really think you're going to make any impact? That's the question you have to ask yourself. If you say, on the other hand, fine, we don't care for the Muslim world, we don't want to make friends with them, we don't want to win hearts and minds, then fine, then let's continue on this line. Let's continue to mock the Prophet and God and religion and everything about the Muslims. And then let's prepare to have this rather chaotic century that we are rambling and shambling into.
Let me give you the kind of typical argument that you hear made, you know, like, well, it's okay for Muslims to be very anti-Semitic in parts of the Arab world. They have no problem with that. A lot of, you know, Muslims in parts of the Arab world have no problem with suicide bombing and beheading, but a cartoon, a satirical cartoon about the Prophet Muhammad, and there's riots all around the world.
I think that's a ridiculous argument. If you're able to condemn, as I have done, the rioting, the anti-Semitism in public again and again, we should also be appealing to other people to understand Muslim sensitivities. This argument that Muslims want to be sensitive, but they are killing people and they're beheading people. If some Muslims are doing it, I've said there are 1.4 billion people. If a few individuals are behaving in a very unacceptable manner or a violent manner, how are they to be held up as representing 1.4 billion people. If the 19 terrorists on September 11 behaved in that way and killed 3,000 innocent people, how can you hold up a whole civilization for that? This is just ridiculous. It's almost like the terrorist argument. The terrorists behead Americans because they say this individual American represents the United States of America and all Americans. These are arguments which are not only palpably ridiculous, but are very dangerous. And they're setting us up for a constant cycle of confrontation. My concern is to pull back from that cycle and begin a genuine process of understanding and dialogue, which leads to some compassion, some love between these civilizations.
Have you become any more or less devout in the past few years as you've seen radical Islam spread and as you've tried to be a force for interfaith dialogue and for comprehension?
I've been, Terry, it's a very interesting question because as a young man, I was much more of a nationalist in the sense I believed in Jinnah and his ideas of a modern Muslim state around the notion of Pakistan. And as I've grown older, I've realized that when we start drawing these boundaries around ourselves, whether they're national boundaries, whether they're religious boundaries, we really are excluding a lot of people. And I've really become much more sophistic, much more mystical in my own interpretation of Islam itself. And some of the finest and some of the most enduring and endearing strands of Islam are the Sufistic forms of Islam, which go straight back to the Prophet again. Here's Rumi, one of the most popular poets in the United States. Rumi, a great Sufi mystic poet of Islam from the 13th century, who talks about going to the synagogue, to the church, to the mosque, and seeing the same altar and the same spirit. Now that is, for me, the essence of faith itself. And that is where I moved to over the last few years.
Akbar Ahmed, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Akbar Ahmed is a professor of Islamic studies at American University. Since 2003, he's been engaging in a series of public interfaith dialogues with Judea Pearl, the father of the late journalist Daniel Pearl, who was beheaded by Islamic extremists in 2002. We heard from Judea Pearl earlier in the show. I'm Terry Gross.